We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in The Nine Tailors by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton, with Peter Jones as Bunter and Timothy Bateson as Superintendent Blundell. Episode 4. The Hunt Moves to France.
Wimsey and Bunter, having deceived the post office into handing over a letter addressed to one Paul Taylor, established themselves in the dark old upper room of the Cat and Fiddle. Lord Peter was convinced that the letter could provide a vital clue to the mystery of the unidentified body in the local churchyard. The visit to Fenchurch St. Paul, that had begun with a strenuous night of bell-ringing, had led to Lord Peter's return to the Fen country in an attempt to solve the mystery. The evidence suggested that the body might well be that of Nobby Cranton, a London jewel thief, involved 10 years previously in the theft of the Wilbraham emeralds from the home of the Thorpe family. It seemed reasonable to assume that he had returned to Fenchurch to recover the emeralds, which had never been found after Cranton was sent to prison. But as to who might have killed Cranton, and why they should find it necessary to mutilate the body, that remained as unclear as ever. But in the upper room of the Cat and Fiddle, the mood was triumphant, and, as Lord Peter quite properly pointed out, the port remarkable, and the claret not to be despised.
Some more wine, my lord.
Thank you, waiter.
Bit quiet here today, ain't it?
Oh, yes, sir. Things is very quiet, but not as quiet as they used to be, sir. The men working on the wash cut make a difference to the town.
Haven't they finished that yet?
Oh, nearly finished, sir. They say it'll be opened in June. It'll be a good thing, so they say, and improve the draining very much. It's hoped as it will scour the river out 10 feet more and take the tide up again to the head of the 30-foot drain, like it was in the old days, by what they tell us.
Oh, I see.
They brought the cut to within a mile of the town now, sir, and there's to be a great opening in June with a gala and a cricket match and sports for the young people, sir. And they say as they're asking the Duke of Denver to come down and open the cut. Oh, but we haven't heard yet if he'll come.
He'll come, all right. Dash it, he shall come. He does no work and it will do him good.
Indeed, sir. It would be much appreciated in the town if he were to come.
I'll make a point of jogging old Denver up to do his duty. We'll all come. Great fun. Denver shall present gold cups to all the winners, and I will present silver rabbits to all the losers. And with luck, somebody will fall into the river.
That will be very gratifying, sir. Thank you, sir.
Did you know, Bunter, that my family have frequently accused me of being unrestrained and wanting in self-control?
Indeed, sir. Most extraordinary.
How little they know me. For instance, instead of opening Mr. Paul Taylor's letter at once, I reserve it for Superintendent Blundell. And instead of rushing off post-haste to Superintendent Blundell, I remain quietly at Wallbeach and eat roast mutton. Now, the envelope bears a postmark which is only half decipherable, but which I make out to be something ending in Y in the department of either Marne or Seine-et-Marne. A district endeared to many by the recollection of mud, blood, shell holes and trench feet.
Ah, yes, sir.
The ink and pen mean little, for I've never yet encountered in any part of France a pen and ink with which any normal person could write comfortably. But the handwriting is suggestive, because owing to the system of state education in that country, though all the French write vilely, it is rare to find one who writes very much more vilely than the rest. The date is obscure, but since we know the time of arrival, we may guess the time of dispatch. Now, can we deduce anything further from this envelope? What do you say, Bunter?
If I may be allowed to say so, my lord, it is possibly a little remarkable that the name and address of the sender does not appear on the back.
That is well observed, Bunter. Yes, you may have full marks for that. The French, as you have no doubt often noticed, seldom head their letters with an address as we do in England, though they occasionally write at the foot some such useless indication as Paris or Lyon, without adding the number of the house or the name of the street. They do, however, frequently place these necessary indications on the flap of the envelope, in the hope that the address may be thrown into the fire and irrevocably lost before the letter is answered or even read.
It has sometimes occurred to me, my lord, to be surprised at that habit.
Well, no matter. I say this is very excellent port. Be good enough to finish the bottle, Bunter, because it would be a pity to waste it. And if I have any more, I shall be too sleepy to drive.
Right. Monsieur Marie. What's that mean, my lord?
My dear husband.
I never knew that Nobby Cranton was... Dash it, where does Cranton come into this? I never heard of it having any wife at all, let alone a French one.
My dear Blundell, we don't know that Cranton comes into it at all. He came to Fenchurch St. Paul and asked for a Mr. Paul Taylor. This, presumably, is addressed to the Paul Taylor he was asking for.
But they said Paul Taylor was a bell.
Taylor Paul is a bell, but Paul Taylor may be a person.
Who is he, then?
Oh, God knows. Someone with a wife in France.
And the other chap, Batty or something, is he a person?
No, he's a bell, but he may be a person, too.
Well, they can't both be persons, not reasonable. And where is this Paul Taylor, anyhow?
Perhaps he was the corpse.
Well, where's Cranton? They can't both be the corpse. That's not reasonable, either.
Oh, possibly Cranton gave one name to Ezra Wilderspin when he took a job with him as a motor mechanic and gave another to his correspondent.
Then what did he mean by asking for Paul Taylor at Fenchurch St. Paul?
Perhaps that was the bell after all.
Just see here, my lord. Doesn't seem reasonable to me. This Paul Taylor or Taylor Paul can't be both a bell and a person. At least not both at once. It sounds, well, kind of batty to me.
Why bring batty into it? Batty is a bell. Taylor Paul is a bell. Paul Taylor is a person because he gets a letter. You can't send letters to a bell. If you did, you'd be batty. Oh, bother.
Well, I don't understand it. Stephen Driver, now he's a person too. You don't say he's a bell, do you? What I want to know is which of them all is Nobby Cranton. Oh, you dash it all, my lord. Let's read the blooming letter. You might read it out in English, would you? My French's a bit off these days.
My dear husband, you told me not to write to you without great urgency. But 3 months are past, and I have no news of you. I am very anxious, asking myself if you have not been taken by the military authorities. You have assured me that they could not now have you shot, the war being over so long ago. But it is known that the English are very strict. Write, I beseech you, a little word to say that you are safe. It begins to be very difficult to do the work of the farm alone, and we have had great trouble with the spring sowing. Also, the red cow is dead. Little Pierre helps me as much as he can, but he is only 9. Little Marie has had the whooping cough, I think, and the baby also. I beg your pardon if I am indiscreet to write to you, but I am very much troubled. Pierre and Marie send kisses to their papa, your loving wife, Suzanne.
Little Pierre, 9-year-old, kisses to their papa, and the red cow's dead. 9 years ago, Cranton was in jail.
Stepfather, perhaps?
Spring sowing? Since when has Cranton turned farmer? And what's all that about military authorities and the war? Cranton never was in the war. Something here I can't make head nor tail of. See here, my lord, this can't be Nobby Cranton. No, this letter wasn't written to Cranton.
It begins to look as if it wasn't. But I still think it was Cranton I met on New Year's Day.
Well, I'd best get on the telephone to London, and then I'll have to be seeing the chief constable about this. Whatever it is, it's got to be followed up.
Ah, Bunter.
Yes, my lord.
Do you recall, Bunter, a young lady by the name of Hilary Thorpe?
Yes, my lord, I do. A most agreeable young lady, the daughter of Sir Henry.
Correct. Well, I've just received a letter from her, enclosing with it a piece of paper which she found in the belfry of the church on the Saturday before Easter Day. She forgot about it and has only now decided to pass it on to me. I should be grateful if you would read it, Bunter. It's causing me some confusion.
I thought to see the fairies in the fields, but I saw only the evil elephants with their black backs. Woe, how that sight awed me! The elves danced all around and about while I heard voices calling clearly. Ah, how I tried to see, throw off the ugly cloud, but no blind eye of a mortal was permitted to spy them. So then came minstrels, having gold trumpets, harps and drums. These played very loudly beside me, breaking that spell. So the dream vanished, whereat I thanked heaven. I shed many tears before the thin moon rose up, frail and faint as a sickle of straw. Now, though the enchanter gnash his teeth vainly, yet shall he return as the spring return. O wretched man, hell gapes. Erebus now lies open. The mouths of death wait on thy end.
Excellently read, Bunter. Well, what do you make of it? Is it a lost work by Sir James Barrie?
Well, my lord, I should say it was written by a person of no inconsiderable literary ability who had studied the works of Sheridan Le Fanu and was, if I may be permitted the expression, bats in the belfry, my lord.
It strikes you that way. It doesn't look to you like a cipher message or anything of that kind?
It had not occurred to me to regard it in that light, my lord. The style is cramped, certainly, but it's cramped in what I should call a consistent manner, suggestive of literary rather than mechanical effort.
True, Munter, true. It certainly ain't anything simple or bucolic of the every third word type. And it doesn't look as if it was meant to be read with a grid, because with the possible exception of gold, there ain't a single word in it that's significant. That bit about the moon is rather good, of its kind. Mannered, but imaginative. Frail and faint as a sickle of straw. Alliteration's artful, what? Le Fanu, did you say? Not a bad shot, Munter. It reminds me a little of that amazing passage in Wilder's Hand about Uncle Lorne's dream.
That was the passage I had in mind, my lord.
Curious, pantomime, very curious. Ah, by the way, you'll find in the cupboard of your room an empty beer bottle of the quart variety.
Indeed, my lord.
Yes, I went up to the belfry again for a look round and found it parked away in a corner. Strange place for a beer bottle, what? So I wrapped it in a handkerchief and shall have it sent to London for a fingerprint check. Be so good as to see to that, will you, Munter?
Yes, my lord. I shall attend to it first thing tomorrow morning.
Well, my lord, I'm glad to say that we've already had a response from the French police in response to our inquiries.
Remarkable.
Looks like they found the writer of the letter. It's a woman by the name of Susan Legros. It's been worked on by a Monsieur le Commissaire Rosier of Chateau, somewhere other, in the department of Marne.
Excellent. Well, I think that ought to be followed up at once, don't you agree, Blundell?
Oh, yes, my lord. All depends, really, on who the Chief Constable decides to send to France.
Yes. Do you speak French yourself, Blundell?
Well, not to say speak it, my lord. I could order a spot of grub and maybe swear at the garçon a bit, but examining witnesses...
Quite a different question.
Yes.
Indeed. Of course, if the Chief Constable were to entrust the inquiry to me, I could pop over in two ticks. At my own expense, of course.
Afraid he might consider that a bit irregular, my lord.
Well, my French is my strong point, don't you know? And I really think that in these hard times we ought to consider the public purse, don't you?
Well, there is that, of course, my lord.
Ah, nous y voici. Please, do sit down.
Thank you.
Ah. It does not in any way astonish me, my lord, to receive an inquiry concerning the husband of Suzanne Leroux. It is evident that there is a formidable mystery. For 10 years, I have said to myself, Aristide Rosier, the day will come when your premonitions concerning the so-called Jean Le Gros will be justified. I perceive that the day is at hand, and I congratulate myself upon my foresight.
Well, evidently, Monsieur le Commissaire possesses a keen intelligence.
Now, to lay the matter clearly before you, I'm obliged to go back to the summer of 1918. Milord will remember the retreat over the Marne in July.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The retreating armies were swept back across the Marne in disorder and passed through the little village of Épernay. In that village lived the aged Pierre Le Gros and his granddaughter Suzanne. Suzanne was 27 at the time. About 10 days after the retreat, it was reported that Suzanne Le Gros and her grandfather had a visitor at the farm, and the police found a sick and wounded man being kept there. Upon being interrogated, Suzanne Le Gros and her grandfather told a singular story. She said that on the second night after the retreat had passed through the village, she went to a distant outhouse and there found this man, sick and burning with fever, stripped to his underclothing with his head roughly bandaged. He was dirty and blood-stained, and his clothes were bedaubed with mud and weeds as though he had been in the river. She showed the clothing in which she had found him, a vest, underpants, socks, and a shirt of regulation army pattern, very much stained and torn. No uniform, no boots, no identity disc, no papers.
It was therefore assumed, I presume, that he had abandoned his clothes when forced to swim across a river during the retreat.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
He seemed to be a man of some 35 or 40 years of age, and when first seen by the authorities, he had a dark beard of about a week's growth.
Then he had been clean-shaven.
It would seem so, my lord.
I see.
Well, the man remained unconscious, in a coma, for almost 3 weeks. When he slowly regained consciousness, it was found that his memory, and for some time his speech also, was gone. But gradually the speech was regained, though for some time he could express himself only in a thick, mumbling manner with many hesitations. He claimed to remember nothing of the past, but nothing. He did not know his name or his place of origin. He had a life which began only in the farmhouse at Epernay. Well, of course, his description was circulated to the French army and the British army, but without result. And after the armistice, even to Germany, but still without any success.
Most remarkable case.
We thought so too, my lord. He was taken to several hospitals and examined by psychologists, but they could make nothing of him. Oh, they tried to set traps for him. They suddenly shouted out words of command to him in English or French or German, thinking that he might display an automatic reaction, but it was to no purpose. He seemed to have completely forgotten the war.
Lucky devil.
Ah, oui, ça je suis de votre avis, but nevertheless some kind of reaction would have been satisfying.
Indeed.
Eventually, old man Legros asked leave to adopt the man as his son. Oh, there were difficulties, but enfin, since something had to be done with the man, and he was quiet and well-behaved and gave no trouble, the consent was obtained. He was adopted under the name of Jean Legros, and papers were made out for him. Eventually, the civil authorities washed their hands of the whole matter, and Suzanne Legros ended up marrying this Jean, and their eldest son is now 9 years of age.
You said in your letter, Monsieur Rosier, that Jean Legros has now disappeared.
Since 5 months, my lord. It is said that he is in Belgium buying pigs, cattle, I know not what, but he has not written, and his wife is very concerned. You think you may have some information about him?
Well, we have a corpse and we have a name. But if this Jean Legros has conducted himself in the manner you describe, then the name is not his, though the corpse may be. For the man whose name we have was in prison in 1918 and for some years afterwards.
Ah, then you have no further interest in Monsieur Legros.
Oh, on the contrary, on the contrary. An interest of the most profound. We still have the corpse.
Ah, à la bonne heure. A corpse is always something. Have you any photographs, any measurements, any marks of identification?
The photograph will assuredly be of little use since the corpse, when found, was 4 months old and the face had been much battered. Moreover, his hands have been removed at the wrists. But we have measurements and 2 medical reports. From the latest of these, recently received from a London expert, it appears that the scalp bears the mark of an old scar, in addition to those recently inflicted.
Aha! That is perhaps some confirmation. He was then killed by being beaten on the head, your unknown.
No. All the head injuries were inflicted after death. The expert opinion confirms that of the police surgeon on this point.
He died then of what?
Ah, there is the mystery. There's no sign of a fatal wound, or of poison, or of strangling, nor yet of disease. The heart was sound, the intestines show that he had not died of starvation. Indeed, he was well nourished and had eaten a few hours before his death.
Tchah. An apoplexy, then?
Ah, it's possible. The brain, you understand, was in a somewhat putrefied condition. It's difficult to say with certainty. But you comprehend that if a thundering apoplexy killed this man, it was not so obliging as to bury him also.
Perfectly, you are quite right. Forward then to the farm of Jean Legros. Madame Legros, permit me to introduce Milord Whimsey, who has voyaged from England to make certain inquiries.
Milord.
Madame.
Your husband, madame, he's absent from home since how long?
Since December, monsieur le commissaire.
Mm-hmm. And where is he?
In Belgium.
You are lying, madame. He's in England, as you well know.
England, monsieur? But I've told you, he's in...
In England, madame. You wrote to him under the name of Paul Taylor, did you not, at the town of Wolbesh in the county of Lincoln? You will not deny your own handwriting, I suppose, or the names of your two children, or the death of the red car. You do not imagine you can resurrect the car.
Monsieur, I...
Come, madame. During all these years, you have been lying to the police, have you not? You knew very well that your husband was not a Belgian, but an Englishman. That his name was actually Paul Taylor. That he had not lost his memory at all. You have falsified papers, madame. That is a crime.
Monsieur...
This is your letter?
Monsieur, since you have found it, I cannot deny it. But...
Good. You admit the letter.
My husband, monsieur, I implore you to tell me, where is my husband?
Well, I...
Madame, we are greatly afraid that your husband is dead.
Oh, mon Dieu, je le savais bien.
Well, if you will help us by telling the truth about your husband, we may be able to identify him. I would like you to look at these garments. Now, we don't know whether the man who wore these is your husband, but on my honor, the man who wore them is dead, and they were taken from his body.
Let me look at them.
You recognize them?
Yes. They are his. I mended these garments myself. He is dead. My husband is dead. Oh, Jean.
In that case, you can do him no harm by telling us the truth now.
Yes. Yes, I understand. It is true. He was an Englishman. But he really was wounded in the 1918 retreat. He came to the farm one night. He had lost much blood and was exhausted. It is not true that he had lost his memory. He implored me to hide him because he didn't want to fight anymore.
It was shameful, madame, to harbor a deserter.
The English are very strict. They might have thought him a coward and shot him. So we arranged that he should pretend to lose his memory. And since his French accent was not good, we decided to make out that his speech was affected by his injury. And I burnt his uniform and papers in the copper.
Who invented the story? You or he?
He did, monsieur. He was very clever. He thought of everything.
What was his real name?
His papers were burnt, and he never told me anything about himself.
You do not know his name? Was it then not Paul Taylor?
No, monsieur. He adopted that name when he went back to England.
Ah, and what did he go to England for?
Monsieur, we were very poor, and Jean said that he had property in England which could be disposed of for a good sum if only he could get hold of it without making himself known. Also, there were difficulties which he did not explain to me about selling the goods. I do not know what they were, and for that he had to have the help of a friend. So he wrote to this friend, and presently he received a reply.
Have you got that letter?
No, monsieur, he burnt it without showing it to me. He chose the name of Paul Taylor to go to England, and he laughed very much when the idea came to him to call himself so. And then the friend sent him papers made out in the name of Paul Taylor, British subject.
And you know nothing of the nature of this property in England?
No, milord. Nothing whatever.
Was it land security? Valuables?
I don't know, monsieur.
Monsieur le Commissaire, could you let me have that photograph of Cranton?
Cranton? Of course, yes. Here you are, milord.
Madame Le Gros, look carefully at this. Is that your husband as you first knew him?
No, monsieur. That is not my husband. It is not in the least like him. You have deceived me. He is not dead. And I have betrayed him.
He is dead, madame. It is this man who is alive. So now, Monsieur le Commissaire, we are no nearer than before to a solution.
It is possible that Madame Le Gros has not told us all she knows. What resources could her husband command, milord?
Oh, how can I tell? But we believe that this mysterious property had to do with an emerald necklace of many thousands of pounds value.
Ah, je comprends. It would be worthwhile to spend the money, then. But this man is not the man you thought.
Now, there's the difficulty. But look, there were two men concerned with the theft. One, a London jewel thief.
Cranton,
that's right, Nobby Cranton. The other was a domestic servant. We don't know which of them had the jewels. It's a long story, but you heard that this Jean Le Gros wrote to a friend in England, and that friend may have been Cranton. Now, Le Gros can't have been the servant who stole the jewels in the first place, for that man is dead. But let us suppose that before dying, the thief communicated to Le Gros the secret of where the emeralds are hidden, and also the name of Cranton. Le Gros then writes to Cranton and proposes a partnership to find the jewels. Cranton doesn't believe and asks for proof that Le Gros really knows something. Le Gros sends a letter which satisfies Cranton, and Cranton in turn procures the necessary papers for Le Gros. Then Le Gros goes to England and meets Cranton. Together they go and discover the jewels. Then Cranton kills Le Gros in order to have the lot for himself. How's that, monsieur? After all, Cranton has disappeared.
Oui, it is very possible, milord. It is certain that there is more than desertion behind this change of name and Le Gros' fear of the British police. But if the man was an old jailbird, the thing understands itself. But there are still many difficulties.
Quite. But if my explanation is correct, one thing is certain.
And what is that, milord?
Both the jewels and the murderer are to be found in England.
In that episode of The Nine Tailors, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael. Bunter, Peter Jones. Superintendent Blundell, Timothy Bateson. Commissaire Rosier, André Moran. Madame Le Gros, Lolly Cockerell. Waiter, Hayden Wood. Narrator, John Westbrook. The Nine Tailors was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers and was produced by Martin Fisher.